It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the House could vote on the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement by the end of the week. We'll get the latest from Washington.
First, the news from the Wisconsin legislature. Yesterday, the Senate and the Assembly passed a slew of bills, some controversial, ranging from a 20-week abortion ban to removing the 48-hour waiting period for handgun purchases.
Here to break down the news for us is Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the 20-week abortion ban. This bill passed in the state Senate yesterday. Did this break down along party lines as it was expected to?
It broke down exactly along party lines. All of the Senate's 19 Republicans voted for the bill. All of the Senate's 14 Democrats voted against it. So there was nobody that split either way on this one. And it would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy, a move that the supporters said is aimed at preventing the infliction of pain on a fetus. But this is something that was pretty hotly disputed by Wisconsin's medical community when this was up for a public hearing.
Now, this has been a contentious bill in Wisconsin. What sticking points were brought up in the debate before the vote?
Quite a few. I mean, this is a bill that has no exceptions for pregnancies that result from rape or incest. So you often see those in abortion-related bills that come up at the Wisconsin Capitol. They're not here. And so the sponsors have said that's because Senator Mary Lozick actually used the term that this would be a late-term elective abortion. And she said that people who would get an abortion as a result of rape or incest would do it earlier in their pregnancy. But that's definitely one of the big contentious pieces of this. Another is that the Wisconsin medical community is roundly united against this. Doctors testified that it's creating terms that the medical community doesn't use in terms of how it measures what is 20 weeks from fertilization. The doctors were saying from the Wisconsin Medical Society, this idea that you're advancing that a fetus can feel pain at 20 weeks conflicts with what the American Medical Association says, with what a National Association of Obstetricians says, that this conflicts with all the research out there. And so they were very strongly against this. And then there was also this provision that was added to the bill yesterday that would go some ways toward addressing concerns over what happens if the life of a mother is in danger. But the wording of it is a little bit vague, and critics of the bill say that what it's going to end up doing is that a doctor would have to wait until a mother's health had pretty seriously deteriorated until the doctor decided to perform abortion in order to save the life of the mother.
Now, another aspect of all of this is whether, if passed, this bill could stand up to a challenge in court. Do we know where that stands and what the thought is on that?
What we know is what has happened elsewhere, and elsewhere laws like these have not stood. The Journal Sentinel did an article yesterday, talked to legal experts around the country, including a conservative lawyer in Wisconsin and a legal expert at Harvard. They all said there's no way that this passes at the district court or the appellate court level, that this would go directly against the guidance that the U.S. Supreme Court has given when it comes to abortion laws and how restrictive they can be. So, it may very well be that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, would revisit the issue of abortion, possibly on a case involving a law like the one that they're pushing here in Wisconsin. But as of right now, this would be found unconstitutional.
And what happens next? Is this likely to pass the Assembly?
All we know is that Assembly Speaker said that his members have not caucused on it, meaning Republicans in the Assembly haven't met privately on it to discuss this. Speaker Voss says he's a big proponent of this bill. He says that, even if it is something that's going to face hundreds of thousands of dollars in court challenges, that's worth it to him. He says you have to weigh the importance of the bill that they're looking at against those costs. So the speaker's a big proponent of this. He's not promising that it's going to come up for a vote, but given the party line vote in the Senate yesterday, you wouldn't be surprised if the same thing happened in the Assembly.
We're talking right now with WPR state government reporter Sean Johnson, talking about the latest on movement of bills in the state Senate and Assembly, and some more action there with legislation. The Assembly voted to end the waiting period for handgun purchases, right? There had been a 48-hour waiting period. Why did supporters of this measure say it's necessary?
They basically made a couple arguments. One is that they said that 48-hour waiting period was put in there because it used to take longer to get a background check completed. And now that everything's electronic, a background check happens a lot faster. You don't need to say you're going to have this 2-day waiting period between when somebody purchases a gun and when they get it. So that was sort of their first argument, is that you can do this faster now. The second argument was they kind of answered your question with a question. One of the reasons we had this waiting period is that it's a cooling off period between when somebody buys a gun and when they receives it. So if they went in to buy a gun angry, or they went in to buy a gun depressed, you have this cooling off period before when that gun is actually in hand. But the sponsors of this bill are saying, well, I think the question should be, why should there be a cooling off period? This is actually something that is an inconvenience for people who want to buy a gun, was their argument, that some people in parts of the state that are far from a gun shop might have to drive a long ways to get a gun, and it would be inconvenient for them to have to make that drive twice.
Now, again, has this been going strictly along party lines, or have there been any crossovers?
What we've had on this bill is we've had a couple voice votes. So in the Senate, you don't have a record of yeses and nos in the Senate on this bill. You don't have a record of yeses and nos on this bill in the Assembly. It passed on a voice vote in both chambers. There are different reasons that parties will decide we're okay with a voice vote on a particular issue. It could be on this one that there were a number of Democrats who were going to peel off and vote for this bill, despite objections from Democrats in urban districts who very strongly objected to it, say it's going exactly the wrong way on gun control. So if Democrats were going to lose a lot of votes on this, it might be something where they just decided to kind of cut their losses and do a voice vote. Could also be that maybe there were some Democrats in rural swing districts who were inclined to vote against it, and that can be a politically tough vote for them. So, we don't know exactly why voice votes happen on stuff like this, but we know that it was going to pick up some bipartisan support usually.
Now, this one passed the state Senate in April, and that leaves the governor. Is he pretty much poised to sign off on this one?
I think you can pretty much lock it in that he's going to sign this. He hasn't said the words, "I will sign this bill," but he has spoken favorably of it. This is something that the NRA likes. He is running for president. For him to veto a bill when he's in a Republican primary that the NRA supports would be unheard of.
Now, yesterday, the state Senate approved Governor Walker's appointment of Michael Grebe to the University of Wisconsin System Board of Regents. And this comes at a time when the regents are taking a lot of scrutiny thanks to a bill that would strip tenure protections from state law. So how big a deal is this appointment?
It's sort of a bigger deal given the circumstances and the timing of the appointment. As you mentioned, this is happening when the university is going through a lot of changes, and changes that are broadly aimed at making the university be run more along the line of a business with more top-down management, maybe less input from the employees or faculty than has been had before. And so now you have this appointment of Michael Grebe, who he's not just any person who works for a manufacturing business in Wisconsin. He is the son of Michael W. Grebe, who is the chair of Governor Walker's gubernatorial campaigns And beyond that is the president and CEO of the Bradley Foundation, which is a conservative powerhouse in the state of Wisconsin and nationally. But here in Wisconsin especially, Bradley Foundation really provides the financial infrastructure for these conservative groups that have helped advance and sometimes form Governor Walker's agenda. So, you know, he is very connected. You know, that's an understatement there. Michael M. Grebe, who was confirmed to this region appointment the other day, and some of the statements that he made in his confirmation hearing had Democrats concerned. He was comparing the university to a business and said, you know, if you have duplicative degree programs at multiple campuses throughout the system, maybe it doesn't make sense to have them everywhere. Maybe you cut them on some campuses if you have them somewhere else. He said it's like a manufacturer might not manufacture the same product at multiple locations. And that rubbed some Democrats the wrong way. They said the university is not a manufacturing plant.
Sean, thanks a lot for talking today.
You're welcome.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR State Government Reporter. He was with us for a roundup of the latest action in the state Senate and Assembly. We head to Washington for the look at the latest in national politics. The votes look tight, but Republican leadership in the House is hoping to pass the contentious Trans-Pacific trade deal by this Friday.
And as we approach the end of June, a Supreme Court decision on whether the federal government can supply health care subsidies through the Affordable Care Act is on the way. President Obama said it's up to Congress to solve the problem if the Supreme Court ends many of those subsidies.
And the competition among candidates vying for the Republican presidential nomination continues to heat up, with Jeb Bush shaking up his campaign leadership ahead of his expected announcement.
Joining us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
We'll start with this Trans-Pacific partnership, negotiations in Congress, not split down party lines, dissension within both parties. Can you spell out some of the politics at play here?
Sure. So basically what we have are, you know, it's going to be mostly Republicans who are going to pass this bill, even though President Obama supports it. But the question is, can you pull off enough Democrats to be able to join with the Republicans to be able to pass what are these? It's sort of a two-pronged bill, but what you're looking for is to give the president fast-track authority so that he could pass this. And what you're also having is that you're trying to assure that those members who are hurt by free trade deals, that they get the necessary funds and benefits regardless of whether or not the deal passes, to basically even things out, even if the deal does pass. And so far what we have seen is that the Democrats have been satisfied that Medicare payouts will not be capped. And so that's one sort of problem that has been put aside. But the question is, can you still put together a majority to be able to pass both of these different parts of the packages? My guess is that they'll be able to, but there really isn't a big Democrat in the Congress who's really taken the lead here in order to pass this. Nancy Pelosi wants no part of it, and Steny Hoyer has sort of not gone either way, but he's certainly not going to help out. So there's still a question as to whether or not it'll be passed, but the Republicans are trying to whip up the votes. They're going to need at least 20 Democrats to do so, and we're not sure if they're going to be able to get the necessary Democrats to be able to pass both of them.
And they're trying to do it Friday in part, I've heard, because they don't want to leave too much more time for lobbying of possible swing Democrats to get them to go the other way. So they want to get the vote in while the numbers are there.
Exactly. You know, as Lyndon Baines Johnson found out, you know, back in the 50s, if you have the votes, pass it now. Don't give them time. Rush, rush, rush. And right now they're just trying to rush it and get it to the president.
Now, other big news from Washington, President Obama saying we're going to send more advisors, military advisors, about 400 to Iraq, where we'd taken a lot of military out since President Obama became president. What's been reaction, if any, from Congress? Is this on their radar right now?
I mean, this just seems like this war has been going on for so long, and each time we think we're going to get back out, we get pulled back in. And the real problem that Congress doesn't want to save, you know, this Republican Congress, although it's hawkish at the same time, doesn't want to save this president. And we know that although President Bush authorized this war and started this war back, you know, in 2002 and 2003, the public right now honestly believes that both former President Bush and President Obama are responsible for the quagmire that we're dealing with in Iraq right now. And so even though the Congress, Republican held, is very hawkish, as I said, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens when a Democratic president asks them to help him out and try and solve what's going on in Iraq right now. And you know what? There hasn't been a lot of discussion of it, so we're not really quite sure how they're going to respond, although there has certainly been a lot of voices, you know, especially in the Republican field right now running for president, you know, people like Lindsey Graham who are going to want as many people as possible to go into Iraq and solve this problem. It's going to be interesting to see how the different presidential candidates respond. And right now, there isn't a necessary clear sign how all of them will. Of course, they're going to be hawkish voices, but there are probably going to be some dovish ones as well.
Not necessarily a unified Republican voice in Congress on this one, in part, as you mentioned, because of the number of presidential candidates coming out of the Senate.
Right, exactly, exactly.
We are talking about the latest news on the national political scene with Harry Enten from 538. Well, speaking of that presidential race, a lot going on the Republican side. And Jeb Bush, a leading candidate, a leading non-announced candidate, been called a front runner, including by another non-announced candidate, our Governor Scott Walker. But he is shaking up his non-existent campaign, changing the staff. What's going on there?
This is, well, according to him, he's not switching up the staff. This is the funniest thing that's going on when you're having super PACs and you can't have coordination between campaigns and super PACs. Bush, who's overseas right now, is saying, oh, I guess I'm going to find out what's going to happen when I get back. Look, Jeb Bush came into this presidential race, officially or not officially, back in December of 2014, and most people thought he was going to raise a ton of money, which he probably has, even if he hasn't raised the amount that everybody thought he was going to raise, and he was going to clear a path, and he was going to march to the nomination without a problem. But here we are, standing on June 10th of 2015, and Jeb Bush has not cleared a path. More candidates, if anything, seem to be getting into this race. And all of a sudden, you look up your Jeb Bush, your negative favorable ratings, your unfavorable ratings are rising among Republicans. You're losing in Iowa to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, and you're saying, what's going on? And so he decided that the person who is going to lead his campaign is, in fact, not going to lead it. He is going to be working out only in the early states, and they've decided to put somebody up who wasn't going to lead the campaign because things are just not going the way that they're supposed to be going as far as the Bush campaign's going to go. Now, whether or not it's Jeb Bush who's the problem or the people leading his campaign, we're going to find out. But Bush better hope it's the people leading his campaign that's the problem and not him. Otherwise, if it's him that just Republican voters don't like, obviously he's in a lot of trouble.
Seems like possibly the worst place to be right now in the Republican field, if there's no clear front runner who's a sure thing, is to be that front runner because you're everybody's target, you're getting the scrutiny, and there's really nothing to gain by being out in that position.
Exactly. You know, if you're out in front, you're going to be the target of a lot of people. Now, if you have a 40-50 point lead, as George W. Bush had at this point in the 2000 cycle in June of 1999, that's one thing. You can take the attacks because of attack here, attack there, what happens? Your lead drops from 40 points to 39 points. But if you're Jeb Bush and you're at best at 15% in the polls, or if in Iowa you're probably in the single digits, depending on which poll you look at, and you are deemed to be the front runner, people are going to pile on. And Jeb Bush has been out of politics for a very, very long time, and it's not clear whether he can adjust to this new era in which there's a lot of social media, a lot of live media. Everything that Jeb Bush says or does is recorded, and it's very easy to get attacks out without a lot of money. And you know what? With super PACs, all the opponents are going to have a lot of money anyway. So even if they needed it, they could do it. But on social media, it's very easy to get attacks out. And right now what we're seeing is Jeb Bush is just not running away with this race.
And one key turning point could be debates coming up, Fox and CNN doing them. A lot of Republican candidates, they both say, we're only going to invite the top 10. And there it gets complicated. You wrote about this. What kind of questions are we seeing about who those 10 are going to be?
Yeah, I mean, we have enough Republican candidates to form a conga line. And, you know, CNN and Fox are hosting these first two debates. Fox is going first. And, you know, I'll just say CNN has been very clear about what rules they're going to use, you know, how they're going to average the polls. They're going to average the polls over, I think it's like a 56-day span or 57-day span. And it's going to be very easy to know who's going to be in and out. And you can disagree with the idea of using polls to determine who they're going to be. But we know that there's going to be, with the CNN debate, there's going to be a 10-person debate, the top 10 people in the polls, and then there's going to be a secondary debate where everybody who's at least hit 1% in three polls over a 57-day period are going to be involved. So all the Republicans are probably going to get into one of the two CNN debates. Fox News, on the other hand, is only having one debate. And what we know about that is it's going to be the top 10 candidates in a polling average, the last five polls, But we don't know which polls are going to be into those polling averages. Fox News has not made that clear to me. They haven't made it clear to anybody. And we know there are going to be ties. And if ties are, you know, if there is a tie, then it could be more than 10 candidates. But we don't know how they're going to treat decimal points. And the fact of the matter is, when we're down to this few, these amount of candidates, and you have Carly Fiorina at 1.6 and John Kasich and Rick Santorum at 2, does Carly Fiorina get in? I don't know. And apparently they know or don't know, and if they do know, they're not telling us.
Lastly, briefly, you are watching for a Supreme Court decision on a challenge to the Affordable Care Act. Could trash a lot of subsidies. Is there a plan B out there?
The plan B is for Congress to act, and good luck trying to get a Congress, a Republican Congress, to say President Obama's high. That's going to be very interesting if the Supreme Court decides to say those federal subsidies don't work in states that haven't set up exchanges. I don't know what's going to happen if the Supreme Court decides to rule against the president on this one. It would make for very, very interesting Congress.
We'll watch for that in the future. Harry, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me again.
That's Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, joining us for our weekly roundup of the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. With college graduation still visible in the rearview mirror and a fresh crop of grads making their first steps into the working world, it's worth asking, what advice do young people need to be successful?
CNN anchor Anderson Cooper recently added his voice to the chorus with his new essay, Why No Plan B is the Only Plan. It got published in a new book called Getting There. In the essay, Cooper says he followed his mother's advice to follow his bliss and go for the one and only job he wanted. Worked out all right for him, but our guest today says for most people, having no plan B, terrible idea.
We're debating that question now. In a dicey economy, is it sound advice to tell young people to follow their passion and move forward without a plan B? Emily Hauser joins us now. She's a longtime commentary writer whose work has appeared in the Daily Beast, Chicago Tribune, and Dallas Morning News. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Anderson Cooper's essay about having no plan B. What exactly does he say?
Well, he talks about how his life started with in his youth. There was a lot of loss and tragedy, and that he, in the search for his own, meeting his own needs and finding out who he needed to be, he struggled and worked really hard and, you know, snuck across borders and lived on $5 a day and things like that, and worked super, super hard and made it to where he is today. All of which is true. I have absolutely no doubt and do not wish to question either Anderson Cooper's work ethic or the way that loss shaped his life. I myself am very familiar with what happens to a young person when they meet incredible loss and grief at a young age. So I have no question about kind of the top of his story, if you will. And I have an enormous amount of respect for the work he's done and the way that he has always dedicated himself to his work. I think he's really, really good at what he does. I mean, I say in my response to it that I have a crush on him, and I do. I mean, it's for real. He's smart, and he's good at what he does, and he's always worked very, very hard. The problem is he then goes on to talk about that as if his life was not still somehow fundamentally different from the lives of most people who are trying to follow their passion and find themselves and throwing themselves with all their hard work at what means the most to them and at what they want to do. And there are so many reasons that people often don't achieve their one goal that to suggest to people, especially people just starting out, high schoolers or college students who are just graduating, that follow your bliss, have no plan B is an actual workable plan is inaccurate. And as I said in my own piece, it's unkind because ultimately you then wind up with your failure on what is perceived of as your failure on your shoulders. And it might have very little to do with you or your hard work.
And Cooper's advice, it's not really something that's unique to him. His story is his own, but that message has been around for a long time. It's an inspirational one, and frankly, it's probably one that a lot of young people want to hear, that if they have their eyes on the brass ring and they really go for it with 110%, single-mindedly, that it can be theirs, and that's what separates those who make it with those who don't. But In today's economy and some of the obstacles to success, do you think it's still practical advice?
Well, you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. I don't think it was ever practical advice. I think that we hear from the people who made it. We don't hear from the people who didn't, right? And oddly enough, Anderson Cooper and I are roughly the same age. We're a couple years away from each other. And though I grew up very much lower middle class, I grew up and went to school in an extremely wealthy zip code. So I had all of the advantages in terms of schooling and the expectations that the society around you has of you for success and you know, a college education and making the best of yourself, and you can do it, that wealthy zip code provided the kids whose parents, you know, were multimillionaires, right? I got a lot of those advantages without having the money. And also, oddly enough, at a very young age, I made a very weird decision, and I went across an ocean and started living in the Middle East out of nowhere for no good reason, really. And I, too, you know, I walked into areas where suicide bombers had just exploded themselves. I walked across, walked from one side of battleground to another on the West Bank. And I had a lot of the same kind of my experiences really do in a funny way mirror what Anderson Cooper's experiences were and did. And my thing never worked out. You know, I tried pretty hard. I worked, I think I grew up being told, if you work as hard as you can, and I think that was very, very true for our generation. If you work as hard as you want and you, like you said, go with 110% for that brass ring, you'll get it. Or at the very least, you'll be able to pay your bills. You might not be Anderson Cooper on CNN, but you'll be able to pay your bills, right? And, you know, I know a lot of people my age, and there are a lot of people out there in a reality that is very different than the one that we were told was ours for the grasping. And I think with the current economy, it's even less practical, because you're telling kids to go out and, you know, Cooper talked about, I believe in creating your own opportunity if no one gives you one. People create their own opportunities or try to all the time, but they also have to pay off their student debts, and maybe they can't afford a ticket to Thailand like he did. And the thing that I always come back to, there are two things that I always come back to in his very specific story. He always did have a plan B, because no matter who he was or what he was doing or where he was, he knew someone could fly him home.
Right. He has a famous mother, if I'm not mistaken. He
right.
went to Yale. So
right.
is he a special case?
I don't think everybody works as hard as he's worked. So he's maybe a special case in two ways. You know, he says at the end of his piece that people are hoping for a magical moment to happen, and my life is proof that it doesn't happen in one moment. You have to work for it. But there is a really unusual advantage to knowing that if you fly into Thailand and get into trouble, someone will be able to buy you a ticket home. And your mom doesn't have to be Gloria Vanderbilt, right? You just have to have more money than most people to know that someone will be able to fly you home. And there's the fact that as a man, he could walk across borders with much greater ease than I ever could. I was always having to be on the lookout because I was a woman. And there are plenty of women out there who are doing great war correspondent work, and I'm not suggesting that I attempted to achieve that and failed. I love what they do, but I'll bet you they have a lot of stories that Anderson Cooper doesn't know about, because he didn't have to face the same things they had to face.
Is there something depressing about that, though, that people with economic advantage and privilege can go for their dreams, but everyone else has to settle for plan B and C and D?
Well, it's demoralizing. I'll certainly say it's demoralizing. I think that we should, you know, I would never tell someone, don't go for what you want. I would never say abandon your passion. I would say try your hardest, because at the end of all things, you'll know that you tried, and that's going to have an enormous amount of value. And it might work. Maybe it'll work. That would be great. But don't beat yourself up if it doesn't, and have something in mind so that you can also pay your bills, because paying your bills and peace of mind is also incredibly valuable.
So as a parent, this is something that I've talked about with other parents and just a couple weeks ago with a friend, one who said, it doesn't matter about money if you're doing something you love. You don't want to spend your life doing something you don't love. And so that's what I'm going to tell my kid. And I was thinking, well, I think a plan B is always a good idea, even though following your dreams is a beautiful thing and no one wants to snatch somebody's dreams away from them. But it seems as though there's a balance that people have to figure out, whether they want to go for practical safety net a little bit or just go for it.
Well, and people often don't realize in, you know, middle and upper middle class socioeconomic groups, we often don't realize what we're talking about when we say just go for your dreams, because we often don't think about the fact that we're presuming that someone will have a car, or we're presuming that someone will be married to someone who makes more money. My husband is why I was able to try to achieve my passion for so many years, because he is in high tech. So I, you know, I lived off of his, he was very happy to do it, but I was able to continue to push at something that wasn't paying the way I needed it to, because I had another income. People have all kinds of reasons why just going for it is all but impossible. Maybe they have poor health. Maybe their parents have poor health. Maybe they don't own a car. Maybe they don't have, you know, there are all kinds of reasons that we need to bear in mind. So, you know, go for your dream as best you can, but don't beat yourself up if it doesn't work, and try to have something in mind as an option for if your car breaks down or you fall, you can't pay your rent.
We're talking right now with Emily Hauser, longtime commentary writer. She has had her work appear in the Daily Beast, Chicago Tribune, and the Dallas Morning News.
The question in today's economy, is it sound advice to give college grads, high school grads, young people, you know, this common thing, follow your dreams, follow your passion, go all in, reach for the dream job, don't worry about plan B. That's what CNN's Anderson Cooper said in a recent essay. We want to know what you think. What do you tell, what would you tell your kids about this idea? Do you tell them follow your dream, or do you say, hey, hedge your bets, have that plan B? What advice did you get growing up? How did it work out for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Emily Hauser, a commentator for The Week. She recently took issue with CNN anchor Anderson Cooper's essay called Why No Plan B is the Only Plan, telling young people to have a single goal and make it work no matter what. It's a kind of follow your bliss advice that's been around for a while, but is it practical enough in today's economy?
We want to hear from you. Is it good advice to say, hey, follow your dream, follow your passion, and good things will come from it, or is it better advice to say, hedge your bets, have a plan B, don't take that long shot, a career effort? Call in at 800-642-1234. What were you told growing up? What do you tell your own kids? Is passion and perseverance enough, or do you need that safety net? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our first caller. We've got Ray joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hi. I want to let the listening audience know, even if you do make it in your plan A, it's always good to have a plan B. I was a musician, and from the age of 18 to 38, I struggled in local bands here, and at the age of 38, because I was in the right place at the right time, I had studied classical music, could read music, play classical guitar and electric guitar. I happened to join the Violent Femmes and toured the world with them, recorded with them, played with them on stage, but I did it long enough to realize that that actually wasn't my dream at all, and now I work as a stagehand here in Milwaukee, and I'm much happier. I sleep in my own bed at night. I did succeed at plan A, but always, always have a plan B and C.
So you got your dream, and then you realized it wasn't really what you thought, so maybe we get to that place we want to be, and it's not where we want to be at all, so it's better to have those backup plans, sounds like, Ray.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think about that, Emily, and maybe not pigeonholing yourself? If you don't have 100% surety that this is what you want, it's better to have options anyway.
Well, I think that's absolutely true in the sense of if only in the sense of your life is going to be more interesting, right? I think that people who stay monofocused, you know, maybe they achieve what they intended to achieve, but but their life won't be as rich. And I'm also a big, big fan of striving to have a rich life that goes beyond our normal parameters of, you know, financial wealth and, you know, our normal markers for a life well led. You know, try to have an interesting life as well, and try to engage yourself in as many things that can give you joy or bring you or, you know, stimulate your mind. But as I said before several times, also bear in mind that paying your bills is a really life-affirming thing.
All right, let's go to our next caller. Thank you for that call, Ray. We're going to go to Daniel in Madison. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, I'd just like to say that if your plan A is based off the current system of getting a job and working for somebody, I think that it's a failed plan to begin with. I think that it's another you can't win at another man's game where everybody's cheating. Myself, I had grown up in South Carolina. I grew up in a trailer. I had a single mother that barely was employed. I came from there, and now I have a career. I have a family. But the trick is I didn't play another man's game. I didn't go out and, you know, if your monofocus is to go and get a job and become an employee for a company, you may make some money, but the fact is that company's never going to take care of you. The fact is the only one that will ever support you is yourself.
Daniel, do you mind if I ask what you do?
Currently, what I do right now is I'm in the IT field.
All right, IT field, and you started your own company.
I actually came to Madison to launch internet for, at the time, was Bresnan Communications.
Got it.
But my point is, and my focus I want to point out, is I had a science teacher, and he changed my life. And he used to do these little tricks, and he used to bet the class. And his answer always was the class would always lose because they were rigged games. And his answer always was never play another man's game because you will always lose.
All right. Thank you, Daniel. And Daniel talking about getting out there and doing it for yourself because you set the rules, you set the parameters. And that involves an element of risk. Being an entrepreneur is a risky business. Maybe that's for a plan A. But what do you think about what Daniel had to say, Emily?
Well, you know, it's interesting because as a freelance writer, that was all I ever did. I didn't follow anybody else's game plan. And now I, after a long time of not making any kind of living that was commensurate with the amount of work or expertise that I was putting into it, I'm a commentator at The Week a couple times a month, but that's not what's going to put my kids through school. What's going to put my kids through college is the fact that I pulled way back from my writing and went back to school, and now I'm learning to be a librarian, and I'm going to be a librarian in my middle years. So my life experience was precisely the opposite of his. So different people, you know, the point, I think, to my mind is there is no one way. There cannot be one way, given all of the many variables that each person brings to what they're trying to do, and many of those variables are things that they have no idea are out there. People's opinions about them, you know, a bad day or a good day on the stock market or whatever. So to my mind, the most important thing is to keep your own personal sense of options open, if only for the sake of being kind to yourself. And when you're telling young people when young people are starting out in life, that is the one piece of advice that I think is probably most lacking. Be kind to yourself. Don't beat yourself up over things that you can't control. Work your hardest, but be kind to yourself.
And we'll go to one more phone call here. Megan joins us next in Madison. Megan, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
Growing up, my parents said, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to go to a four-year school if that's not what you want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I just kind of went from thing to thing, wherever life seemed to kind of take me. And I didn't have any confidence to go after what I wanted, which was to write. And it wasn't until now I'm in my 30s that people are telling me, like, yeah, you're good enough. You have talent. You can do this. And I asked my mom, why didn't you push me to go more in this direction? And she didn't really have an answer. And I think maybe Anderson Cooper doesn't realize that not everyone really has this big dream or knows what to do with themselves. We don't have the confidence to go out and really go after something. So for my mom and my dad to just say, you know, do whatever you want, we'll support you, but I really needed some guidance. And beyond just saying, do what you want, and then we'll be okay with it.
Got it, Megan. Thank you for that, sharing that story. And Emily, do you think parents need to be more involved in helping their kids make that decision as we get ready to wrap up here?
I think that it's important that we be as honest as we can with them, and part of that is also admitting our own humanity. There's only so much we'll ever be able to tell our kids or guide our kids in a way that will lead them to, you know, a life of success and happiness, right? But I will say that that kind of support is a really important piece of anybody's ability to move ahead, and not everybody has it. I think that point is correct, that there's absolutely a need for support if you're going to even try to make a big dream come true. And for a whole lot of reasons, not everybody has it.
Well, Emily, thanks a lot for joining us and talking about it today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
That was Emily Hauser, longtime commentary writer. She writes for the Daily Beast, Chicago Tribune, and the Dallas Morning News. And you can keep this conversation going with your thoughts, your feeling about having a plan B or not, over on the Central Time Facebook page.
On this day in 1928, children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak was born in Brooklyn, New York. His most famous creation, Where the Wild Things Are, won the annual Caldecott Medal in 1964. It's almost always in the conversation when it comes to best kids' books ever.
It's the story of a boy who has a temper tantrum and sails away to a tropical land where he becomes king of the wild things after his mom sends him to bed without any supper. It was kind of a dangerous story at the time, a book about kids and anger, and it's gone down in history as an honest book. And Sendak said kids are ready for it.
I have total trust in children, complete and total trust in children, and their incredible awareness of life, which is much keener and sharper. They are the little fawns who have to get up and run, and they have to know how to do that. And we must help them by telling them the truth.
That's late Maurice Sendak talking to Steve Paulson on WPR's To the Best of Our Knowledge. This is a big one for you. I think a lot of kids' books that I read to my kids wouldn't have existed without Where the Wild Things Are.
Right. It's a fantastic book. My daughter's been really into it. And, of course, you have to love one of my favorite phrases of all time comes from this book, let the wild rumpus begin.
Which is how you get us pepped up before each edition of Central. Well, you don't, but you could.
I could. I think
we
it
can
should
make
be
that
our,
a thing.
Our new thing.